Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Date a Scientist? I've got the lovely Melton Ballam with me today, who's currently in Vermont in Canada. It's minus one, didn't you just say?
Yes.
Freezing. How are you? How are you doing?
I am great. It's been a wonderful year. Everybody talks about the negative aspects of COVID, but it's been great for me to realign myself and decide my next steps as a data scientist and help the community to build a sustainable AI. So I took some time to study different angles of AI. Now I feel like I'm full cycle and I'm just getting back to the business world again. I don't know what is next. I'll tell you in a bit. But now I am enjoying Vermont skiing and with the family, taking care of my mother-in-law, my dog. So it's been great.
Lovely. Nice and relaxing as much as you can. So thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. We've met before and I wanted you to come and share your knowledge with the world. So can you talk me through your career, Melton, and kind of what got you into data science?
Yes, that's a funny question. And I was 10 years, 8 or 10, it's between that period of time that I was watching Mission Impossible, the original Mission Impossible. Yeah. With my family, my father and my mother. And I saw this system, fingerprint recognition system, opening the doors. And I turn around and tell my parents, I want to be the fingerprint expert. And then my father actually walks out, brings a box of ink to me, and we start from here. It all started there, but then they got tired of me just dropping the ink all over the place. It was not very desired outcome. So I started to go, they started to take me to the police departments and talk about fingerprint recognition. Then my father figured out that there was a science magazine. So they started to buy me the science magazine, and fast forward 15 years later, I actually worked on fingerprint recognition almost for 10 years. Brilliant. And I even consulted Interpol. That was one of my dreams.
Wow. That's
yes.
Like, you really are Mission Impossible.
and then that was, I think, end of the first part of my career. So I started from scratch, developing algorithms around AI, machine learning. It was not called really machine learning. I was in the computer vision department of a NATO subcontractor research center. And slowly we started to have the impact of the second AI winter. I'm not old enough to remember the first, but this was the second AI winter. So I started to think about what to do. Should I go to business? I had a little bit of taste of business. That was not the right time for me to move to the business. So I quit my job. I backpacked to the Netherlands to see what I really wanted to do. I started with math department. And then I moved to the neuroscience. I worked on human brain, particularly the visual cortex and developmental disorders. And then I ended up being here again 15 years later. I am readjusting my career again. And I think, like, going back and thinking about why neuroscience, it brings back my childhood, because I always knew that I was different. And my communication skills were different than anybody else. I was punished by the teachers that I didn't like to write or I didn't like to communicate with others, mm-hmm. but I was very good at math. So I can still enjoy the paper and pen of the math. I think that was the first part that I decided neuroscience, and I started to work on dyscalculia, a couple of developmental disorders, to really tap into my own problem. But it was not until I think I was late 30s that I went to a speech therapist, because I got a lot of comments about my heavy accent, my writing, my speech. So I couldn't really understand what was it until this very young, newly grad speech therapist who actually studied cluttering told me that I have this disorder called cluttering. It mm-hmm. affects my voice. It affects my writing. It affects my speaking. So I feel like I'm in this body, I'm thinking something, but something else is coming out.
Sure. How has that affected you as you've gone in through your career? Because your career is absolutely amazing. And you've reinvented yourself a few times, you know. So how do you think that's both helped and hindered you throughout your career?
Definitely. I mean, it affected me positively. In a lot of senses, I learned how to be determined, and it gave me also I take the feedbacks at the limits that they can see me and they can know me, mm-hmm. Because everybody's feedback is going to be what they can see outside. And I got a lot of like comments about my education being a PhD and not being able to poise or communicate like others with the PhD. I mean, for a while it affected me negatively, but yeah. Then now I'm looking back and I'm thinking that really helped me to build the soft skills that I can communicate more than any technical person. So I had to work on that. But going back, so how it affected me, there was a time, this is no joke, I was in Australia, I was invited speaker. So I studied, practiced, my speech was so good. Mm-hmm. So I got up there, I was introduced, and then the only thing came out of my mouth was, "This is Meltem Balan." The whole speech was over. I couldn't find any word. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't go anywhere. But I mean, those things really built me. And I know, I want to be, as much as I like math, I also like how to communication with the people. Yeah. I'm a human-centric data scientist. So all in all, I think now I know what was everything all about, and how can I carve into a future for the people like me? Because you cannot see any problems when you look at me, but you can judge me because I have a very heavy accent that is not very common in the educated world, mm-hmm. specifically when you're moving up your career in the United States and at an executive level, they expect somebody more poised. Sometimes they put it in the sense that politically savvy, but it's not, I mean, even though I'll be with the behavior and the knowledge, coaching and everything else, I can observe that. Maybe I cannot give it back. So yeah. In that scenario, I'm dedicated for DEI because I believe in the DEI is all about creativity. And I believe that I can be the voice of the neurodiverse people in the sense that I can feel, I cannot have their experience, but I can feel what they are experiencing at a certain level.
Wow, that makes sense. Thank you for explaining that. Thanks very much. So what advice would you give to somebody who's just starting out? And let's go down the neurodiverse path on this, because, you know, I do love, I practice DEI or D&I, as we call it over here. And I haven't done anything neurodiverse on the podcast yet. So it will be helpful for everybody out there to hear it from, as you just said, from your point of view. So what advice would you give somebody who is neurodiverse and would like to get into data science, or if they're already doing one job and, like you, want to change their career into data science?
I think the determination and believing what you're doing are two important things, because people told me a lot of times that I cannot do it. You know, they told me I cannot have a PhD because I have to write. I cannot be at a place that I am at because I cannot talk. But it's not true. I can do all of them. I have to work harder, and I have to be very determined to find the best path for myself. So those are very important things. Like, nobody else knows what the best path for somebody. And most of the neurodiverse people who are coming from, like, for example, Asperger diseases or Asperger or high functioning autism, they definitely are gifted, more gifted than I am. I'm the least gifted of the neurodiversity. So whatever your gifted part is, just try to shine that, and then bring in the other tools around you to add upon other differences. And then don't worry about showing your differences to the other people, because at the end of the day, data science is all about being creative. There is a science in it, even though people kind of de-emphasizes the science part. Science part is very important. And interpretation, different interpretation of the data is very important. So it is very important that you are aware of your differences, and everybody is aware of your giftedness, because this, and you will find the place. I mean, I tell people that don't try to, this was my coach told me, don't try to fit in, just feel like you belong. And you're going to know when you belong. So that's the only, I think, the last note that I can give. Just find the place that you belong and believe in yourself.
Thank you. Definitely believe in yourself. And I think, I mean, I never felt I belonged for a long, long, long time. I think all of us have got to some extent that we don't necessarily feel like it. I'm not saying for one second that it's anything like the struggles that you've had. So is there anybody that's helped you specifically within data science, or somebody that you look up to in the field?
I mean, there are a lot of people that I look up to in the field, but there's, I want to talk about early stage of my career, that I got out of college, and then I didn't get the job that I really liked. I was actually accepted, but because it was more of a robotic engineering and being on the field, as a woman, I was not accepted there. So I had to move quickly, and I had to find myself a place where I could really work after college, because I had to pay my apartment.
Yep.
So I joined to a Turkish research center, which was part of NATO. And initially, they didn't have a desk and chair for me, so they put me next to the administrative assistant. And one morning, the the head of the department comes in and then sees me there, and he asked me like, why am I sitting there? I'm like, they didn't have any other place for me to sit, so I'm working here. And then he put me in his room, so I actually started it, and all those meetings, that decision-making meetings that he was attending, he taught me not only how to be a algorithm developer, it was called algorithm developer, but also how to be a leader. I mean, I will never forget what he did to me. I actually sat in his room 3 months. So we shared the room 3 months. I'm just like newly grad, a person undergrad. And then this person is the head of the entire department of 5,000 people. So it was a great experience for me. And then he's the one pushing me to get a master's degree, later on PhD, which didn't work first. I'm ABD with one PhD, and the second one worked finally. But he gave me this new way of thinking, because my family, my mom was a teacher, my dad is a banker, but they didn't understand like the world of engineering. And my grandparents always thought that as an electrical engineer, I changed the lens.
Yep.
So that was, I think, the biggest opportunity that I got. And I tried to mentor throughout my process. I tried to mentor everybody who actually calls me. It's not possible, but I was given that opportunity, and I want everybody to have a similar opportunity. So Women in Data Science is a great, great organization. Margot Gerritsen is another role model for me, just pushing forward. And that team all together, Judy, Karen, they are great role models to really open up this way for all women as well.
They're wonderful. They are wonderful. We met in the Women in Data Science group on LinkedIn, which is where I meet lots of people who identify as female that have come on the podcast. So I thank Margot, Karen and Judy very much. What do you think is the most interesting part of data science?
Most interesting part is like day-to-day changing job. Okay. Usually it's a process, you know. For me, you start with the data, you start massaging it and start learning from the data. You never know what your data is going to reveal. And then another day, you figure out how to look at this data from different angle. And then at the end of the day, the communication comes, like how you're going to interpret this data and how you're going to talk about your results. So it's kind of day-to-day changing and process that you grow with your data, and your data grows with you. So it's kind of I call it like the sibling relationship. you start playing together, and then you start growing and you start getting mature.
That's so lovely.
That's how I call the data science.
Perfect. I really like that. That's really lovely. Okay, so what's your favorite project that you've ever done? We can talk about the neurodiverse AI, and talk about anything that you want, human first tech.
Yeah, so data science. fingerprint recognition. Fingerprint recognition was something that I dreamed about. I got obsessed that I also went above the borders, where I found my advisor in Texas. His name is Brian Evans. He's in UT Austin. And I was in New Turkey. I didn't even know English to begin with, but I just found them. I don't even know, because I thought that fingerprint recognition is about signal processing back then. Now I was looking at the pattern recognition articles and the signal processing articles in the lab, and I saw his name. So we had to wait until night because we had modems, you know, if you remember.
I remember modems.
So I had to wait like 12 hours to email him, and I had to wait 4 hours to get into phone call with him. But he believed in me. We didn't know each other. We met each other in 2018 for the first time face to face. But I mean, that fingerprint recognition is something that I really enjoyed. But recently, and I think all in all, being a neuroscientist and understanding the human aspects of it, I definitely enjoy the aspects of the sustainability of AI, how mm-hmm. we can build the AI human-centric. And me being neurodiverse, when I talk about an algorithm, or when I try to explain something that I am doing, it's just, you know, you always had formulas, you always had this data science team. It's not part of the product, but you just sit there, do math. The way that you try to describe to the business and how to communicate or be part of this liberal art and business community as a data scientist, those projects are the ones that I really enjoy. Like, I cannot tell the name of the project, but one of my recent projects with General Motors involved a lot of UX designers, a lot of engineers, so from IT to the business units. I was able to oversee all different teams and delegate different parts of the project. It was really, really satisfying experience for me. I mean, it was definitely like agile flux, like the startup environment, but it was very enjoyable because I learned a lot. And that particular project actually made me to decide to really buy a book called Computing in the Age of AI. And then later on, you know, I get obsessed. That's my maybe the high functioning part. And then I actually got to take classes with these professors in Harvard. That was the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
That was the whole thing that I spent almost 4 months to get into their radar and take this class.
Wow. You go and get it, don't you?
Yes.
You see something and you get it. I love that. Oh, it's so inspiring.
So everybody neurodiverse will understand what I am saying, because we are always like, we have something, obsession. It's not being perfect, I mean, anymore for me. I worked on it quite a bit, because if you're neurodiverse, you want to be perfectionist on one thing, whatever that you obsessed. Now I'm learning that I dial down that and then learn it as a, use it as a learning opportunity. So my writings and everything on the LinkedIn started to change, because I know it's a process. I change my LinkedIn blogs and messages every day, check the grammar, check what I'm saying, add people in and out. So it's a process now.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, something that I learned. And I'm just dialing down this very determined, just go-getter with this learning process.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Honestly, it's so inspiring to talk to you. I'm feeling great. Okay, so let's talk about, diversity within algorithms and AI and stuff like that. And normally I focus on gender or ethnicity. How can we make sure that those algorithms or the AI is diverse for neurodiverse people?
Oh, it's really difficult because, like, when you're talking about, you know, women or race, it is still like a uphill battle in data science.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to have the impression that we need to cover all neurodiversity. We need to cover everybody, you know, visually impaired, verbally impaired. Maybe we cannot, but what we can do is that we can build an inclusive community. Like, you know, when you talk about data science, what do you think? What is the data science? Who are the data scientists? Everybody thinks that, you know, you're coming from an engineering degree. You're coming from something that you have some math background. But there are different angles. Like if you get some liberal art degree people who can actually pose their questions well, who are not afraid of asking questions, and they can look really from a different angle of the window, and they are trained to be kind of skeptical, in positively skeptical in the sense. So I think if we can at least break the boundaries between these different disciplines and put everybody in the same room, they will break the glasses and they will actually yell at each other. But at the end of the day, I think we can build more inclusive data sets because it is hard. Like I don't know how many people are diagnosed with cluttering. And also cluttering comes with high functioning autism sometimes.
So okay.
How are you figure out like which is the driver and how which angle that we are gonna come for a disorder like mine, or for there are a lot of gifted ADHDs, you know, mental disorders like the you know, anxiety disorder, panic attacks. So how are you gonna include those particular cases in your data? I don't know any other answer than breaking the boundaries, putting everybody in different rooms. They might not have the experience that somebody with neurodiversity is having, but they might be bringing different perspectives to the table. So that's very important. And I think the biggest problem that I'm seeing in the technology is that the people who are in specifically in data science and AI, we are not in the business world. We are just like, we get like small place on the decision-making tables. Yeah. I understand like CEOs, CTOs understand the business aspects of it better. But when they decide about what data is going to look, how the AI is going to work, it really takes all that creativity and inclusiveness out. I think that's where we can address like how we are going to push the AI leadership. And should it be some leadership model that your AI leaders are independent coming in and out? Because do you need like really AI personnel? I mean, it's obviously it's kind of profits. Like, do you really need a high level employee, executive level, full time, or you want to do like fractional angles? Because then, you know, that person doesn't have a chair, doesn't have a seat, you don't pay as much, but at the same time, they can be independent, they can be objective. So should it be that way, or should it be like somebody on that table to close those gaps? I don't know, but the biggest gap that I'm seeing there is just creating garbage in, garbage out, because the AI person, data science person cannot tell the execs where to invest and how to invest and how long this project is going to take.
Yeah. So my friend I've been speaking to recently has he's neurodiverse. And he started a space dedicated to understanding, sharing, and exploring the positive elements of living a neurodivergent life. And I just wanted to give it a shout out on the podcast while we're talking about it. It's great. It's called ndpositive.com. I'm going to link it in the show notes. Take a look at it, because it's, I think he's not long been doing it. And the more people that know about it and can share it and can talk about it, the better. We need to be having these conversations. So thanks, Yogi, for that.
Awesome. I'm definitely going to find him and figure out if I can help him.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, I'm going to tell him. I'm going to see him tomorrow. I'll tell him.
Awesome.
Oh, amazing. Okay, so I could listen to you chat all day. Like, honestly, I think you're amazing. So, but we're going to go to the question about the billionaires. Oh my God, I didn't ask you your favorite piece of tech, did I?
No.
Right, let's do that now. I am so sorry. What's your favorite piece of tech?
I guess it's a difficult question. There are two. One is my Garmin watch, running watch.
Yep.
And the other one is the cell phone. My dream is like I can have this cell phone and then I can do my data science on my cell phone.
Oh, cool. Invent it. Do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Heard it here first. And then it will be on your watch. You'll be running along doing your data science.
Yes,
Yeah. Thank you.
My watch doesn't do that yet, but my cell phone might. I mean, I did a research on actually the tablets, and then I tried a bit, but we are not quite there to replace the computers and the laptops with the tablets or the cell phones, but that's
it's where coming, I'm, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm rooting for.
Okay, so the world is full of billionaires that shouldn't exist. Not the people themselves. I mean, the status of billionaires shouldn't exist. Do you think that one of them or some of them could build an evil supervillain with all the money that they've got, take over the world? And if they do, /are, what should their punishment be? And how are we going to stop them?
Oh, no, great question. I think it's not going to be in the close future, maybe a couple generations from here. It could be. I mean, it could be a weapon. I mean, this is not new. I mean, the super villains used to, like, we talk about peace. Peace came from the wars. So some people had to make money in the industrial age, building tanks, building weapons. So I am seeing the fact that the super villain is going to be again the power game. So it's going to be some sort of cyber or again biologically motivated kind of weapon. But how it is going to happen, how we can punish those people, I think we should give their weapon back to them as the pill. And then we should put them in a cage that the world can see, so we can put them in a zoo that world can come and see them.
Brilliant idea.
And how we can fix this in the short term. I mean, I'm not an economist, but I can see from how everything else is happening, how we see that people are looking for becoming millionaires and billionaires. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a lot of startups. You see a lot of startups believing their own lies. I mean, the Elizabeth Holmes case, because she believed. I mean, she's a villain right now. Everybody talks about it, but she felt like she had to do it because everybody else is doing it. Yeah. And she came out and was able to raise that much of money, having nothing on the back. And we should change this. We should, instead of like trying to raise the bottom up, we should be trying to push the top down. And And then when you push the top down, the bottom is automatically going to come up. Mm-hmm. So I think the sustainable technology, we were talking about the AI era, is going to be in between here. But I know this is like so idealistic to come to this point that you push the top and the bottom up.
Yeah.
But maybe somebody come up with a idea, superhero idea.
Yeah, to do that. I mean, I think it can be done. I really do think it can be done, and it would make the world a better place. But I think that the people that have the money at the moment will not let that happen.
No. And yeah. but I think there will be a point where it might break.
Oh, certainly. I hope soon, but I don't think I don't think in my lifetime. But yeah.
Neither do I.
So have you got anything you'd like to plug before we go, or anything you'd like to mention, talk about?
Oh, maybe my brainchild. It is not quite happened yet. But I was, as I said, I was talking about changing a little bit of how we look at the AI and how we design the AI. So I started to think about the four components of it. You know, AI starts with the strategy. So we need to figure out what are the strategies are, and AI ends up with the culture. So like how we can change the culture. It's like digital culture, the company culture. And in between those, you have like this data ingesting or pipelining aspects of it. And then the governing aspects of it from the ethical point of view or the legal point of view. And then the engineering discipline, the building everything blocks together and putting as a software engineering discipline here. So I actually convinced a couple of people from my network that we started this company, which is kind of halfway public. And we're going to test the idea where we can find a problem in the beginning and help the companies when they are small enough that they can address the problem and they can develop more sustainable, purposeful engineering and AI solutions. So we put this platform, and we are also inviting individuals who want to be the part of platform. Ooh. To come and put their name on it. But it is just still my brainchild, and I'm looking for different ideas, helping company. I have currently helping companies and shaping with them my better companies.
Yeah.
But that's a concrete engine that is my brainchild, and currently three more people believe in me. And
I believe in you.
Yes, you're starting to be the fractional consultants that we are going into places and then serving as a consulting basis. And I cannot tell you the details
of course.
Just learning.
Yep.
that's my current news.
Perfect. So you mentioned that you'd like people to sign up and get their name on the platform and whatever. How can people contact you to do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn or email me.
Perfect. Lovely. I'll pop those both in the show notes.
Awesome.
Actually, I'm just going to pop your LinkedIn in the show notes because You never know. Hundreds of thousands of people might listen to this.
I know. Definitely. They can come to Concrete Engine. I mean, I recently actually convinced somebody coming from DEI angle, and they understand the inclusive aspects of this.
Yeah.
They are not coming from they are social scientists and they want to be part of this. Yeah, we have engineers like ex-Rucker, you know, you mentioned about the cloud, but I have ex-Ruckers coming in the board. We have Django engineers coming from healthcare industry.
Brilliant.
I mean, it is just shaping. It's going to be, we're trying to be like purposeful in the same who we are including, but we are coming from this fractional angle where how we can be independent, how we can actually tell our minds, not poised, not like wearing suits and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I think my dream, my brainchild is gonna throb. I can hear that.
Oh, brilliant. I'm gonna watch you all the way. Oh, thank you so much, Melton. It's been lovely to speak to you. I really appreciate you coming on.
Your dog is calling you.
I know.
My husband just closed the door because my dog came and said hi to us. But
yeah, I think someone's at the door. Thank you so much. You're an absolute star, and I'll speak to you soon.
Yes. Love to chat with you. Bye.
Bye-bye.